The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is comic book author Mark Andreyko, who's written for Wonder Woman, Batwoman, Doctor Strange, and many more. You might know him for his work on Love is Love, an anthology to benefit the victims of the Pulse shooting. Mark got his big break in comics at a young age, almost entirely by accident, and since then he's been peppering queer stories into comics wherever he can. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly livestream on May 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And by the way, if you like nerdy queer podcasts, you might enjoy my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends for an escape into a world of fantasy with drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. You can subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app for Queens of Adventure. Now, here's Mark. Well, this week I'm speaking with New York Times bestselling writer, creator of the Love is Love anthology, Mark Andreyko. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. I'm a fan. It's nice to be here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The entertainment that changed my life, there's so much to choose from, but the one that changed my life in the most conscious way was the TV show Moonlighting, the Bruce Willis, Cybill Shepherd show from the 80s.
Okay, how did that, come into your life? Like, were you, and how old were you when you were watching it?
I was 15, and I believe it was in January, and I was homesick with the flu, and I turned on the TV, and there was this show on, and I started watching it, and it was like nothing I had ever seen before, and I just knew, I said to myself, I want to do that. I didn't know what that was, but I knew something in the arts, something in that. Mm-hmm. And
what were you seeing on screen? Like that you were looking at, like what were you seeing there?
Well, it was just, I think that it was meta before meta. It wasn't even a term. It was self-aware without being smug. It pushed the boundaries and embraced theatricality and breaking the fourth wall. The first episode I ever saw was one where Cybill Shepherd's character, Madeline Hayes, was the supermodel, and her accountant stole all her money and went to Brazil and opened a casino. And the only other thing she had left was this dummy company called the Blue Moon Detective Agency. It wasn't a real detective agency, and that's where Bruce Willis worked. And they just started, and she kept it, and they started having adventures, as one was wont to do. And this was an episode where Maddie found out where her accountant was, and she went down to South America with David, and it was very sort of casino royale. And it was just funny and sharp and tart and sweet and romantic, and there was just something about the chemistry and the way they did the show. I mean, that show's DNA is in everything on television right now. If you watch a scripted television, something in it was lifted from Moonlighting. They did The Taming of the Shrew, an entire episode in iambic pentameter. They did a black and white film noir episode narrated by Orson Welles. It was one of the last things he ever did. They did an episode that was choreographed by Twyla Tharp. I mean, they did fourth wall breaking episodes. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing show. And I've gotten to meet Bruce Willis, which was lovely. And I got to say thank you for my career. And so the only one left, I need to meet Cybill Shepherd and thank her. Just because I literally wouldn't be talking to you today if I had never seen that show.
I mean, meeting Cybill Shepherd is just like good life goals for anybody, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm 100% gay, but Cybill Shepherd, I think it moves a little when you're around Cybill Shepherd because she's just gorgeous.
So when you saw it, like, as a 15-year-old, did you have, mm-hmm. like, interest in the arts? Like, was that something that you had previously been aware of being into, or did that just awaken
something
totally
new? No, it wasn't like I was going to be a rocket scientist and then suddenly threw it all away to become an actor. No, I was always interested in the arts. I had been, you know, I'm a writer of comic books, and I learned how to read when I was 4 years old from Spider-Man comics and Sesame Street and the Electric Company. So I at one point I wanted to be a comic book artist, and then, you know, with seeing Moonlighting, it sort of opened up the idea about what about television or film and that sort of thing. And then I wanted to major in theater in college. So it just sort of expanded my horizons and really proved to me that I wanted to be in one of the creative arts. That was something that I needed to do.
What sort of creative projects did you have at that age?
Well, I mean, you know, I was writing stuff for myself, you know, just in notebooks. I was doing community theater, so it was you know what you could do in Ohio in the 80s.
Did you have like other people who were into moonlighting as much as you were?
Oh no! I was pretty crazy into it. It was when a new episode was on, I'd be there with the VCR, dubbing out the commercials and typing up running times on the labels and taking the phone off the hook. That shows how this was 35 years ago. So no one could call during the hour that Moonlighting was on, because back in the day, the show had such a rough production schedule that you didn't get 22 episodes in a row. There would be weeks and weeks without a new episode. So an episode was an event. So yeah, I was a little obsessive about it.
And I'm trying to think back to the show. Like, I have not seen a ton of it, so I don't know if there's like, were there ever any like gay episodes or gay characters on it?
You know, I don't think so. But I don't remember it being, it was never mocking or anti-gay. You know, there are some things you go back and look at and you're like, oh, wow, this is really hard to watch. You know, like the biggest example I can think of is Teen Wolf and Monster Squad are two movies that as a kid I really dug. And you watch them now and you're like, oh, that's a little tone deaf. But I think there's an inherent gay sensibility to Moonlighting in the sort of self-aware sort of camp. I think it's the closest to camp that a straight-leaning project can be and still feel like it's in on the joke. It's just, you know, there was just, it was magic in a bottle. Lots of shows have tried. On paper, the show sounds like it could be a nightmare, but it's just one of those things where, you know, oh, your peanut butter's in my chocolate, your chocolate's in my peanut butter. Hey, this tastes great. So I'm hoping it gets rediscovered. I'm hoping that they'll restore them and put them out on Blu-ray. Because I think, from at the very least, from a historical standpoint, if you love the history of television, it's a show that is you can't overstate the import of what it did for storytelling. Which I feel like it sounds like I own stake in the show. Mm-hmm. I have no horse in this game. This is just my fandom that you're scratching here.
So what did you want to do? Like getting out of Ohio and moving out into the world. Like what were your goals like as a young adult?
Well, you know, when I first started, it was, you know, acting, because that's the shiniest, that's the piece of tinfoil that the crow sees first. And then when I went to college and was majoring in theater, then I started directing. And I really, really felt much more confident in that world. I was a thoroughly competent actor, and that's almost worse than being a bad one, because at least bad ones are interesting to watch. And then after that, I started writing, and mostly writing just for myself. I never had any, if you had told me, you know, when I was 20 that I would be writing full time and making a living doing it, I'd be like, wait, what? So it was just sort of out of necessity. It was just easier for me to write my ideas myself than try and micromanage someone who I'm explaining them to. And, you know, 25 odd years later, I'm talking to cool people like you and having books on the New York Times bestseller list. It's all very low-rent Fellini.
Sure. Well, so what were the stories that you were telling? Like, what were you writing? And it sounds like you were doing a little bit of illustrating, but figured out that, like, writing was where you really wanted to focus.
You know, it was just a matter of illustrating just takes so much dedication and so much work and so much. I just don't have the patience. Didn't have the patience to. I know what. When I would draw, I knew what I wanted it to look like, and I wanted to skip ahead. And I just didn't have the grit for the amount of discipline and technique and that you need to do as an artist. And writing was, like I said, it was just shorthand. I tried to tell friends story ideas and have them develop them, and then I would end up kind of like standing over their shoulder, and I'd be like, oh, I should just try this myself. Instead of destroying friendships, I should just try and do this myself and see if it works. And somehow I hoodwinked people into thinking I'm an okay writer. And it's a weird life. It's a good life. It's always interesting to look back at where you thought you would be and where you are and how you're always completely wrong.
Do you have any projects from around that time that you're particularly proud of?
Well, in my senior year of high school, a bunch of buddies of mine and I got together and started our own youth theater company, and we did a bunch of productions for charity for a children's hospital in Cleveland. And the oldest person in the group was 19, and the youngest person in the group was, I think the kid that played Tiny Tim was like 8. and we did 99% of it ourselves. You know, it was sort of that whole Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, I got a sewing machine, I got a barn, let's put on a show. So we did. We did that a couple of – we did three productions through that that raised money. And then what else did I do? In my senior year of high school, I wrote my first screenplay, an adaptation of a book. And, you know, I didn't own the rights to the book, and but it was just for myself how I would make the movie version of that. And that was sort of – I felt myself liking that process a lot, and so that kind of nudged me along the way.
So as you're getting more into, like, writing stories and discovering, it sounds like there was a period where you really started to hone in on comic books.
Well, I grew up reading comic books, you know, a huge fan since I was 3.5, 4 years old. And from the age of 11 all through when I was 25, I worked in comic book stores. Comic books were always a huge part of my life, and it's funny now that comic books and superheroes are the generator of popular culture, because when I was a kid, it would be easier to be an out as a gay kid than it was to be out as a comic book reader. It was something that, you know, it was like a secret society, the people that were fans of that stuff, because comic books would rot your brain. And getting into writing comic books was completely serendipitous. I went to Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. Yes, that one, the May 4th one. And I was working at a newsstand, and a guy came in and bought an animation magazine, and I started talking to him about it. And it turned out that he was a famous comic book artist who I knew lived in town. His name is Pete Craig Russell. And he's done all sorts of stuff with Neil Gaiman, the creator of Sandman, and he's adapted Oscar Wilde's fairy tales and Wagner's Ring Cycle into graphic novels. And we became friends. And in 92... he was talking about this Doctor Strange project he had done in the early 70s, this annual, and he was supposed to write the whole thing, and then they gave it to a different writer, and the story changed. So I said to him, well, why don't you approach Marvel and do a director's cut? And he did, and then I saw him a couple weeks later, and he said, I asked him what was going on with the book. He said, yeah, we're going to do it. When can you start? I was like, what? It's like, oh yeah, you're gonna write with me. So I don't like telling that story to people that want to break into comics, because it's literally like being at the soda fountain at Schwab's and getting pulled into this. But and that was the beginning of the end, or the beginning of the beginning, depending on how I feel the day you ask me.
Did you feel ready to write that book with him?
It wasn't necessarily writing from whole cloth. It was taking his original story and sort of doing not Gus Van Sant's Psycho, because it wasn't a recreation. It was retelling what his original story was with new stuff. So yeah, I did, because I was young. You know, when you're young, you're fearless and you don't really think about things. You're like, oh sure, I'm gonna get paid and I'm working with this guy, and my first job is writing Doctor Strange. Sure. So and Craig at that point was already a very good friend of mine as well. So it was the safest of place. You know, if you're gonna dive into the deep end of the pool, he was a good life jacket to have, to use a weak metaphor.
So what was that book like? What was your actual role on there, and what were you able to contribute?
Well, I originally suggested him just drawing the ending that he wanted, but his art style had changed so much in the subsequent 25 years that we went through the original book and saw which pages we were going to keep, but he redrew those pages in his new style. So it was a little bit of what's up, Tiger Lily. It was, you know, if that's a reference that I need to explain, you know, that was a Woody Allen. It was a Japanese film, and Woody Allen dubbed it in English and didn't know what the script was. So he wrote his own script just based on the visuals. And then there was a little bit of adding new scenes that we talked about. So it was the best way to learn the process, because I got to learn, you know, and my degree in college is in directing theater. So I like the collaborative process. So working with an artist of Craig's caliber was like, you know, having Robert De Niro do your student film. So I learned so much on the job, as it were.
And then where did you go from there? Like, you suddenly you're like in the middle of everything. You're working on a project for, I think it was Marvel, right?
Yeah, it was Marvel. Where I went from there was, it wasn't, you know, it was still not something that I thought I was going to be doing. I thought it was a one-off. And I had a bunch of friends there who are comic book artists. And one night after we were out, and I pitched an idea to them, and then a couple of them said, let's work on that. And it was just sort of like, it just sort of happened. And then before I knew it, you know, once that Doctor Strange story was published, I was reached out to by a couple different editors at Marvel and DC, and they're like, hey, we like that. Would you like to work for us? And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I didn't even think about this. And now, like I said, 25 years later, here I am, you know, writing comics and making a living doing it. It ain't too shabby. It's nothing to complain about.
So what did you start working on? Like, what was your first job?
My first job after the Doctor Strange was I got approached by an editor at Marvel to write. They were doing a black and white anthology series. And he asked me if I had an idea for a Wolverine story. And the artist I got to work with is this great Italian artist who's done stuff in heavy metal. His name is Maxim Milano Frizzato. Just amazing stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah. So I wrote a story called Beer Run, where Wolverine's playing poker with a bunch of other heroes, and they're out of beer. So he takes Nick Fury's flying car to go get beer, and hilarity ensues. It's very, to think that it happened on Mulberry Street inspired. And then from there, I got other offers, and then I did a book with friends of mine that we created called The Lost, which was a contemporary sort of sequel to the Peter Pan story set in New York City. And then that made some noise, and I just met people, and, you know, it exploded from there.
You mentioned at the time that you were growing up, coming out as gay wasn't as stressful as coming out as, like, a comic book nerd. Did you feel like, did that start to change at some point? Like,
I was speaking a little hyperbolically, I mean, to talk about how the world has shifted in nerd culture. Now nerds are cool. I was coming of age. I was 13 in 83. So I was gay, Catholic, hitting puberty, and in the midst of an awful, awful, awful time in the history of the world. So, you know, it was a really interesting time to grow up. And I'm completely aware that if I was 10 years older, I could be dead. I could be, you know, I could have lost everyone I know, because I have a couple of friends. I have one friend who's in his 70s, and, you know, he was in New York there, and he said he went to like 700 funerals in 2 years. That's insane. So I'm very aware of the fortune I have to have been on this side of that crisis. But it's been interesting growing up gay in this timeline. This timeline is never uninteresting.
When you were, like, figuring out being gay and you know, kind of figuring out who you were, was there a point where coming out and being gay and like the work that you were doing, like being in comic books, did those ever feel like they were in conflict?
No, never, actually. Even before I officially, and my parents were the last people I came out to, and I can talk about that if you want. I've always been out as a comic book creator. I've been fully out, and I've never experienced any homophobia. Now, I don't know what they say about me when I leave the room, but conversely, they don't know what I say about them when they leave the room. So I've never had to deal with any homophobia, and working with DC Comics in particular, as much as I have, DC has been a progressive, cool, very LGBT-friendly company before it was popular to do that. The entire time I've been there, they've been nothing but cool, and if anything, say, you know, create more content that reaches to that audience. So,
are there a lot of queer people working in comics?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's two main camps of people that read superhero books. There are the guys that want to be the superhero and get the girl, and there are the guys that want the superhero. Because superheroes are basically naked. You know, they're idealized, perfect bodies. And there are tons and tons and tons of LGBT creators. And there always have been, but particularly right now, there's, you know, because it is much easier to be open, there are a lot of them for us, as it were.
So as you're getting more into the comics industry and becoming more of a professional there, were there, like, gay elements that you wanted to put into your stories, and were you able to do that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. you know, in that the Peter Pan project I mentioned, The Lost, the kids, the Lost Boys are street hustlers. So there was definitely some content there. I did a graphic novel with my buddy Brian Bendis, who comic book fans know is like the preeminent writer in comics. We did a book called Torso, which is based on the true story of Elliot Ness in Cleveland in the 30s, one of the first serial killers in the world. And I felt it was really important to have a gay cop character in that story, because some of that killer's victims were street hustlers. And I thought it would be really interesting to not only do a story that explored forensics in the pre-forensic era, but what was it like being gay when that wasn't even really the term for it? So I've always had gay content. You know, I'm not a put gay characters in just for the sake of having a gay character appear. I think that causes as turns off as many people as it might bring in. But you know, I try to put in honest characters, and more often than not, that means gay characters populating my work because mm-hmm. I'm gay and gay people populate the world. But I've never been one to put in because even as a kid, as a reader, when things got didactic, I instantly got resistant to it. You know, I'm much more the spoonful of sugar than the eat your vegetables type of writer.
Are there instances that you're particularly proud of putting something queer into a book that you think worked well and you know, brought people, I don't know, maybe had a good influence on people?
This wasn't creating gay characters, but the anthology book I helped organize called Love is Love, I'm probably the most proud of. It was an 144-page graphic novel anthology, and we raised money for the victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting. And we've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are international editions. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. J.K. Rowling let us use Harry Potter, which is the first time and probably only time Harry Potter will ever appear in comic book form. Patty Jenkins wrote the introduction. I mean, it was, and I've gotten to meet survivors and then people, family members of those who died. And it's been the most gratifying, humbling privilege to be able to have given people that had such a horrible loss, to give them even a brief moment of a smile or knowing that there are people out there that care about them. So that is, you know, that's the first thing that'll be in my obituary, and I am good with that. As far as creating gay characters, in this book I do for DC Comics called Manhunter that takes place in Los Angeles, the main character is a federal prosecutor named Kate Spencer who prosecutes supervillains, sort of the metaphor for celebrity crime out here. And her law partner is a gay man. And when I was doing the book, I asked DC, I said, I would love to have him date a gay superhero. Who could I out? And so I got to take a character who I went back and read his history. And I was like, oh, they might not have intended him to be gay, but this tracks, you know, sort of the way Peppermint Patty tracks as a lesbian and Charles Schulz didn't actually make her that. Just weird how characters tell you their own sexual orientation. So that was cool. So I got the, you know, I have a gay superhero in a committed relationship with his boyfriend. So, and he's an out superhero as well. So,
do you find, you mentioned moonlighting is like this important pivotal piece of entertainment for you. Do you find like yourself putting moonlighting into your work?
That's definitely shaped my sense of humor. Absolutely. I think I do like situational and contextual commentary on where you are. I think, you know, it is when it's done well, it's a great device to read or to watch. And in real life, it diffuses dark, tense situations. So yeah, absolutely. That show has made a huge impact on me. And I still today will cite things when I'm writing or when I'm talking about someone else, sort of like that sort of thing that happened in that episode. And it is really fascinating what we imprint on and what imprints on us.
Yeah. Like, do you find yourself, like, do you encounter moonlighting fans like as an adult now or like interact with people online?
A friend of mine just put on Twitter saying, Hulu or someone needs to start streaming the show. The show's not available digitally anywhere. And wrote this huge essay on it. And I didn't know he was a Moonlighting fan, and I didn't know all these other fans of mine. And went on this whole Facebook thread of and I told that story that Moonlighting's the reason I'm in this business and everything. And it's everything old is new again if you wait long enough.
You mentioned that you have interactions with fans about it. When did that start becoming a part of your work, like having fans?
I even hate saying that. It sounds so, my fans. I always feel like a little Christina Crawford in front of the mirror and Mommy Dearest. It's such a great thing. It's such an honor to have people, as a writer, I try and write stuff that I would spend the money on that I'm asking people to. And when other people respond to your work, it's just the most gratifying and humbling thing. The internet's made fans more accessible and made people get more of them. I mean, you just look at internet influencers and that sort of thing, and how many people you have on following you on Facebook or on Twitter. It's weird. I'm still a little Catholic schoolboy trying to not make waves underneath it all. So when people are like recognize me and want to take a picture with me or something, I'm always weirded out by it. It's great, and I try to be as gracious as possible. But I never get used to people I don't know saying my name. I'm like, do I owe them money? Am I getting served? What's happening?
When did that start happening? When did you first notice that people that strangers were recognizing you?
Well, I started doing a couple years back. I started doing my friends did a show called Movie Fights and Screen Junkies, which was like an entertainment news fandoms streaming show. And I did that. And was a competitor in Movie Fights, and currently I'm a competitor in this movie trivia network where it's movie trivia meets professional wrestling. We have characters, and you're a face or a heel, and that gets 30,000 to 100,000 viewers. So I get recognized all the time, which is weird, and I now understand why people who are legitimately famous don't live in big cities. Because it's if people recognize me and I'm plankton in the food chain, it must be exhausting. And that's not to sound ungrateful, but when I have friends who are substantial, I have friends who are super famous, and I watch them interact, and you always have to be, you can't be having a bad day. It's sort of like being a waiter. The people you're serving don't care if you're having a bad day. You always have to be on. So I have an immense amount of respect for legitimately famous people who are very active with their fans, because it's awesome, but it's also a lot of work.
Do you feel any sense of responsibility to the gay fans in particular?
My responsibility to gay fans is being out and trying to help younger fans know about the past, because I think this is something we've seen both culturally, not just in the gay community. A lot of young people don't know history, and history is super important. And as someone who saw so much history get obliterated during the AIDS crisis, I want the kids today that have much more freedom to be out and be who they are, I want them to know who got them there.
Who do you look back to as the people who got you where you are?
Oh, so many of them. Harvey Milk, Larry Kramer, who has always been a divisive figure. But you know what? You look back at him in retrospect, and he was right 9 times out of 10.
When you look back at Larry Kramer, for folks who aren't familiar, what is he divisive about? Oh, and what does he write about?
Larry Kramer, Larry Kramer was an abrasive guy. I mean, he found, one of the ACT UP founders, and was out there screaming bloody murder at the beginning of the AIDS crisis, and was there saying, hey, we should shut down the bathhouses. This disease is being spread by them. And, he wasn't loved by a lot of gay people, and he wasn't loved by a lot of straight people, but he fought. And, a lot of the AIDS therapies and treatments that we have now wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for him and the other great AIDS activists of that period. And looking back, you look at things, at things that he was just just write about as far as the monetizing of health and things like that, and having to, if someone's not going to do it for you, make them do it. And, the fact that he's still alive is miraculous. You know, he's in his 80s now, and he saved lots of lives. He's one of those people that I see interviews with him, and you know where you stand. There's no bullshit with him. Now, that might come off as abrasive, but it's like, it's like your pets. You always know where you stand with an animal. They don't have any reason to blow smoke up your ass. And I think that that is something that, growing up gay, there's so much hiding of who you are and so much being accommodating to not make waves, that seeing someone like him who has zero fucks to give is inspiring.
How did you come across him?
Growing up in the crisis, I started learning more about him when I was in college. And read The Normal Heart and saw productions of The Normal Heart and read the band played on and all that stuff, and just got and as I became more and more comfortable as a gay person, I just wanted to know as much about gay culture as possible, as much about the history and as much about, as a writer, most writers will tell you the research is the most fun part. You get to dive in and learn things. And for me, because gay was still sort of a secret handshake club in the 80s, it was a way to connect with the gay community that I couldn't overtly growing up in a predominantly white suburb in Ohio in the 80s.
What did gay even look like to you at that time?
Well, I think I always knew. I remember being a kid and like, oh, there's an episode of Chips and Ponch is playing volleyball in a Speedo. I like that, and not knowing why. So I've been very fortunate in that I was never suicidal. I was never, beating myself up about it. I knew it was different, and I wasn't necessarily sure what it was, because the terminology was not very expansive. I mean, when I was a kid, Three's Company was a controversial show, and that was a show about a straight man living with two women pretending to be gay. It was basically the gay equivalent of blackface. And now you watch that show and you're like, oh, this is, I'm really uncomfortable. So the civil rights arc for gay in my lifetime has been insanely progressive. But I never felt a lot of overt homophobia. I mean, there was, the word fag was tossed around a lot in the 80s, but most of the time, at least in my community, we didn't really know what it meant. It was just sort of that thing. It was, like I said, I did not come out to my parents officially, though, until I was much older, mostly because, I wasn't dating anyone. I never lied. They never asked, so I never really lied to them about it. And, there's no matter how progressive you think your parents might be, I remember thinking, oh my God, when Chaz Bono came out to Cher was pissed. If Cher's going to be pissed, what are my parents going to do? And then Matthew Shepard got killed. And I had a long, hard look at myself in the mirror and said, this kid died because of being open about who he was. And I can't do that anymore. I have had a really good, fortunate childhood and have a good family, and I need to do this. So I chickened out and I wrote a letter and sent it to my parents. And my parents were so much more awesome than I could have ever hoped, wished, or dreamed for. But I'm super lucky in the fact that, ever since I was a little kid, I remember my parents saying, do what you love to do. Don't do something because you think it's going to make us happy. You're going to be doing this long after we're dead and buried. So follow what you're passionate about. And I didn't realize how rare that was until I was an adult. So yeah, I underestimated my parents' reaction, and they I'm a very, very lucky man.
When you finally were ready to come out to them, like, what was that process like?
Like I said, I did it in a letter, and in the letter I kind of said what I said to you. I said, I don't know. I'm assuming, I don't know if you might not. If you don't, here it is. The reason I'm doing this now is because of seeing what happened, you know, seeing what happened to Matthew Shepard and what happens to gay people around the world. Being out is not just a thing one does for oneself. It is there to hopefully make the transition for other people as well. So I just kind of articulated that to them, and I told them, you know, I said, don't worry, I've been tested, I'm safe, you don't have to worry about any of those extreme things that I'm sure you're gonna, the worries that you'll have. And, you know, I just sort of presented it to them, and they were, like I said, both exemplary about it. You know, mm-hmm. I apologized to my father because I said, you know what, I'm a bad kid, because I really would never, I didn't think your reaction was going to be awful, but I didn't think your reaction was going to be this. And that is a reflection on my badness, not a reflection on you. Because, you know, it was like, there's so many ways that can go south. And there are, like I said, there are so many people that you would think it would not be an issue with, and it suddenly is. That to have your father, who's a second generation, who grew up in a blue collar family, who's a second generation American, to have them not only accept you but embrace you and be sort of nonplussed about it is really, it's what it should be for everybody. So I know that's a real rambling answer. I'm sorry, but hope that answers some of the question.
Have you put Cummings out in any of your books?
Yeah, I have. In the graphic novel Torso, a younger cop comes out to his partner, which was interesting, writing a coming out scene set in the 30s. What does that sound like? And in the book Manhunter, the comic book I do for DC, the main character, she has a son. And when the first series ended, the last two issues took place 15 years in the future, so her son was in college. And as I was writing it, I called my editor and I said, I think Kate's son is gay. And she's like, yeah, I thought so too. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to force you into it. I'm like, yeah, no. So it was like, because I said to her, I said, this isn't an agenda thing. I think, you know, the kid, I said, Ramsey's a gay guy, right? So it's always fascinating when, I know that sounds pretentious as all hell, but when characters tell you who they are, it's really cool.
How much of yourself do you see in your books?
I think a lot. You try not to make, you know, the hardest thing about writing is giving characters individual voices. You try not to make them all sound like you in different form. But for instance, in something like Manhunter, the character, when she builds herself a costume out of confiscated supervillain technology to go after bad guys who thwart the system. And she'll kill some. She wouldn't, like I said, she's not the Riddler. I mean, she's not the Punisher. She wouldn't kill, like, the Riddler's a bank robber. She wouldn't. But she doesn't know why the Joker is still alive, because at this point, the Joker's killed hundreds of thousands of people. And I write her from a point of view I don't necessarily agree with, about, like, the death penalty and capital punishment. So I try to incorporate my sensibility into things I write, but also explore points of view that aren't necessarily mine and try and write from them.
So when you look at the books, like, have you slipped, like, autobiographical details into any of the works that you've written, or I don't know, like, been inspired by experiences like your coming out?
I mean, yeah, I think you throw stuff in. I think it's, for me, it's just a matter of, like, seasoning more than an entree. You know, I'll throw in a story here and give it to a character that it was based on something that happened to me, or a relationship inspired by a relationship that I have, you know. But I have not written anything that's very, very autobiographical.
When the Love is Love anthology happened, I know, like, that came from a bunch of different writers and artists and stuff. What was your, like, do you remember when you first saw that book, like, when you first, like, held it in your hands?
Yeah, I was in New York City and had a copy of it. It was amazing to see, because it went from an idea I floated on Facebook the morning after the shooting, and it was in stores 6 months later, and there were over 600 people that worked on it. And, you know, it was an experience. I will never complain about any of my editors ever again, because after wrangling a project of that size with two real editors, Jamie Rich and Sarah Gatos, for the primary editors of the project, seeing what they had to go through and them donating basically hours upon hours of their life to help this book become a reality. It's a lot. It's a lot making art happen. So yeah, it was interesting, but I like that. I like, you know, when I was in college, my theater program, we had to take a semester of all the different facets of theater, whether it was wood shop, scenery, lights, costumes, acting, stage management. And I like knowing what everyone does and having a grasp on it, because then I know what I don't like to do. And I know what jobs, you know, I assistant stage managed once. I will never stage manage again. I love stage managers because that's a job I would never want. And I think you need to try and experience, you know, life is a salad bar. Try everything. There are going to be things you don't like, but you won't know them until you try.
Well, that, I mean, seems very in keeping with the way that Moonlighting was produced, like that you'd have all these different sort of, like it would jump into different genres and things every now and then. And it's like, well, what is the show? It's a lot of different things.
Yeah, ultimately, it's like, ultimately, when people say with my work, what is this? I hope they say interesting or good. Genre lines don't need to be defined. And I find some of that times, you know, we like to label and compartmentalize as humans. And I like knowing, and I follow artists and creators. I follow them, not the type of story they're telling. You know, I'll go see anything Ang Lee does, because even if it's not great, it's going to be at the very least fascinating. You know, and what sort of genre does Ang Lee direct? Well, he directs film.
You mentioned that your favorite phase is the research phase, because you get to explore so much stuff. But it seems like even the writing process, like you talked about the exploring who the characters are when the characters reveal themselves to you. So it sounds like a lot of the work that you do is just like a process of discovery and surprise.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, to go back to the metaphor, well, you know, I describe my process as the crock pot process. You know, when you're doing the research, you put all those ingredients in the crock pot, turn it on, and walk away, and come back 10 hours later, and all these flavors have melded and different flavors have risen. And it's a way to, you know, it's why I like to have multiple projects in development at any given time, because I can't, when I only have one, I can get tunnel vision and psych myself out. But when I have a bunch, if I have four different things that I'm working on, if I get stuck at one or need a break from one, I can go over to this other one. And that's usually when the best ideas come from, when you're not thinking about a project. It allows your brain to relax, and then you're like, oh, now I know how to fix that scene. So that's sort of my process. And there's nothing about the process that's horrible. I mean, this is not a bad job to have. There are, you know, the most tedious part is probably, you know, it can be rewriting.
It seems like there's a lot of surprise in what you do, that, you know, you put everything together and then you step away and then you come back and you're like, oh, huh, well, I wasn't anticipating that, but let's go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a framework. Like when I'm writing a story, I'll write, you know, if it's a screenplay, I'll write 20 bullet points and, you know, break down the acts and stuff. But then when I do the actual physical writing and start the full dialogue and the scene stuff, sometimes it changes. I think I like to have enough of a spine to my work that I know, worst case scenario, I know where this is going. But best case scenario, I know what the destination is, and I find different routes on the journey to get there.
And just your own career as a writer.
God, that sounds so pretentious. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, it sounds kind of familiar, like, In your work as a writer, like, is that sort of the approach that you've taken, like, that you didn't know exactly how you were going to get there, but you knew what you wanted to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a part of my whole life as a creator. You know, when I direct theater, if I read a play and I know exactly how the entire play is going to look, I have no interest in directing it. If I read a play and I know how two or three of the pivotal scenes probably should look, and the rest of it scares the shit out of me, mm-hmm. that's what I want to do, you know? And sometimes it comes out great, and sometimes it comes out a admirable failure. But if something is fully formed, there's no real fun there. It's why I'm not a novelist. You know, I like working with other people. When I would direct a play and a gel and a light would change a scene, or the way an actor held a prop would change a scene, or the way a costume made the actor walk, or the way the set changed the scene. I loved stuff like that. I love the happy accidents and that sort of thing, because I'm not a novelist. I'm not Emily Dickinson. You know, I'm not going to write this and then hide it in my underwear drawer. I like the social part of collaboration and seeing and being inspired and inspiring people around you. That's the fun part.
What's the most fun you ever had on a project?
Oh gosh, I've been really fortunate. You know, most of the projects I've done that I haven't enjoyed were projects done early in my career. When you're young, you take every job and make the best of it, because you need to, first of all, you need to learn your craft, and you know, a paying gig is a paying gig, and you find something that makes it fun for you. And also too, the older stuff, you know, you get better the more you do something. But as far as the best, I've gotten to work with so many great people and so many friends and so many people that I've admired that, you know, it's, I think I would say Torso I'm very proud of, because when Brian and I did that book 21 years ago, to see where we both are career-wise now, neither one of us would have believed we are where we are. And to be able to go through this, and now Brian's far more successful than I am, but to go through this with a friend, even on a smaller scale, is sort of awesome, because we have similar experiences and going through. That was great. Creating Manhunter, co-creating Manhunter for DC, having a character that's in the DC universe that knows Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and is part of that tapestry now, and that fans enjoy, is hugely cool. It's basically a pretty cool job, you know. I would certainly like to have a 401k and, you know, regular dental cleanings, but I get to write superheroes, and, you know, and I get to live in Hollywood. I get to, you know, work with people I've admired my whole life, so it doesn't suck.
So if people want to check out your work and see some of the books that you've written, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, if you have a local comic book store, especially during this quarantine time, most of my stuff is available, and supporting your local independent bookseller is really important right now. There's always the Amazon. There's a lot of my work is available if you are a subscriber to the DC Universe streaming app. Most of my DC Comics work is available digitally on there. They have a great library of, I think, over 50,000 DC comics that you can watch on your high def televisions, which I admit, much like Sally Field going to the mall in soap dish, I read my own comic books on television because I could. And I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and you can see me compete in movie trivia matches on the Movie Trivia Schmodown, which is streaming on YouTube.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was nice. It's nice to meet you. Like I said, I'm a fan of the historical work you do, and you're a nice guy. So it's a win-win for me.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Mark for joining me. My recommendation this week is for something that you can't have yet. Get in touch with your local comic book shop and pre-order a copy of Lords of Empire: Emperor Hulkling, written by past Sewers of guest Anthony Oliveira. Anthony's work is always smart, loving, and super-duper gay. And this particular story will give him an opportunity to write about a same-sex relationship between Hulkling and Wiccan, who have a relationship dynamic that Anthony particularly loves to explore, what he calls anxious soft goth boys and their enormous golden retriever boyfriends. Lords of Empire: Emperor Hulkling comes out on July 22nd, but you can pre-order your copy now, and times being what they are, your local comic shop sure would appreciate it. And thanks again for listening. Thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers in the mail, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the patron-only podcast Cozy Pants, in which I chat with my partner James about the entertainment that's bringing us joy right now. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on May 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my other podcasts, Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy shows featuring drag queens on epic fantasy adventures. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.